Welcome to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders impacting our community. Text your comments or questions directly to the studio in real time via ZipWhip landline texting at 540-371-5756 or comment on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
There is a lot going on at the James Monroe Museum downtown, and we're going to talk about that. A lot of things this spring coming up, and Scott Harris joins us again, but we're going to talk a little bit more about the James Monroe Museum this morning. But first of all, Scott, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Ted. Nice to see you.
It is good to have you here, and we are going to talk about the James Monroe Museum, but there have been a few changes going on and just kind of the structure of things, and I thought we'll start off with that with you.
Well, let's see where to begin.
Well, I guess the one of the places to begin is the James Monroe Museum is part of the University of Mary Washington.
Yes, it is, and has been in one form or another since 1964. And around that same time, the historic estate Belmont, the home of the artist Gary Melchers and his wife Corinne, which had been under state control through the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, was also transferred to, at that time, UVA and its women's division, Mary Washington College. And, mm-hmm. of course, we've evolved today, University of Mary Washington. And over the years, both Belmont and the James Monroe Museum were gradually and sometimes fitfully incorporated into the structure and the identity of the college as it evolved toward university status. And there were a succession of people who did wonderful things there in helping build those resources and the legacies. And we come to more recent times, University of Mary Washington, relatively new president, and David Barath, who had been the director at the Gary Melchers Home and Studio for 27 years and had did wonderful expansion of the mission of the facilities there, retired last year, June, and it prompted a conversation, actually a conversation he and I had had informally for a couple of years, but took on new meaning with his retirement and with the atmosphere of reexamination and reorganization at the university. Long story short, position or the Department of University Museums is being created. I've been named the executive director of University Museums with an overall administration of the Gary Melchers Home and Studio, the James Monroe Museum, and the papers of James Monroe.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. Very excited. Opportunity to help advocate for and advance the respective missions of all of those entities while at the same time fostering closer internal ties with the university and mm-hmm. also expanding the external audience and support. Joanna Catron, who's been the curator at Gary Melchers Home and Studio and has been the acting director since David's retirement, is assistant director and curator and will be the day-to-day manager of the Gary Melchers Home and Studio. Jared Kearney, who's been curator at the James Monroe Museum, is also becoming assistant director and curator and will do the same function for that museum. And the papers of James Monroe, which has been at the university about 20 years doing a long-term publication project of Monroe's correspondence, that's led by Dr. Dan Preston, and that continues as before.
Exciting. This is exciting. Especially those two museums, and you look at the day and age we're in with technology and all the things you can do with museums. I'm sure in the back of your mind, there are not things you want to talk about now, but I'm sure you've got some ideas of things that you can see that could be done here.
Yes, and we're very new in this whole scenario. We did have an announcement to staff just before Christmas, for our Christmas break. I was actually confirmed in the position I have January 25th, so we're still putting the framework of this together. Mm-hmm. And as I said in a memo to the staffs of all the university museums components, it's a process that we will discover together, what it will be and what it will not be. Fundamental to this is that the missions and the identities of the Gary Melchers Home and Studio, the James Monroe Museum, will not change. In fact, ideally, to most external visitors or supporters or consumers, they're not going to notice a difference. They're not going to see that there's any real distinction from before. What we're looking for is, in appropriate cases, some combining of effort, respective staffs helping each other at events, some cross-training maybe for interpretation, maybe some combined efforts toward marketing and grant writing, resource development. Those are the things we're looking at initially. And having a strategic plan for university museums that's sort of coordinated and complementary, I guess is the best way of putting it. We also have moved up one level from reporting to the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, which was a great relationship, but I now report to the Provost, who is a member of the President's Cabinet. So we've moved up to a level of reporting responsibility and access that I think will be really beneficial.
As someone who's a University of Mary Washington, or in your case, a Mary Washington College alumnus, a graduate, this also has to make it just a little bit more special. This is your school.
It is my school. It's very gratifying. In fact, this year is my 35th anniversary. The reunion's coming up in June, and it's like, oh, how did that happen? My wife is an alumna. We met there. Some of the best friendships of my life. People we both know in some cases are people that I first encountered at Mary Washington. Some of those people work today there, as do I. So it is. It makes us particularly special. Previous experiences in my career have, without any plan whatsoever, kind of helped toward this too. I've been the director of multi-site museum systems. I have been, as you know, at the New Market Battlefield, which has a mix of historic and modern buildings and large outdoor component, even a visitor center, regional visitor center. So a lot of these past experiences I think are going to help inform putting this university museum's operation together.
Well, it's exciting. We've done over the years shows with both, and we'll continue to do shows with both museums. And now you're kind of the person who's in between both of them now and involved with both. So looking forward to it in the years ahead. And this is the first time we've had a chance on air to talk about these changes. So it's exciting. So again, you're the director of university museums. Is that
I'm the
name?
Executive director.
Oh, the
of
executive
university
director.
Museums,
not just
if
the
you don't mind.
Okay, just not director. We'll change that quickly.
That and $2 will get me this cup of coffee I brought in this morning. But it's very gratifying. But that's the title.
Had I not known you, and I saw because it says University of Mary Washington alumni, and if I didn't know you, I would have wondered. Is he really an alumni, or is he just in somebody's office and he liked the cup? And
it's all a sham. Yeah.
Pocketed it. Scott Harris here this morning, the executive director of University Museums. When we come back, we're going to jump into and talk about some things going on in the James Monroe Museum, a number of exciting things coming up over the next few months, and we'll talk about that this morning on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
You're listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Got an opinion about today's show? Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Now, here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Scott Harris here this morning. He switches hats now, and we talk about the James Monroe Museum and a number of things going on. I guess your mother never taught you not to wear a hat inside, so we'll have to get that taken care of before this whole executive director thing
sets in. If your head gets
in.
Cold, I'd be happy to lend it to you. But
okay.
There, so okay.
Number of pretty exciting things going on. The spring is usually, in recent years, every month you have things going on, but especially in the spring. We're going to get into all the things going on. The first thing you have coming up is this Friday night, and it was supposed to be a couple weeks ago, but it's had to be moved just because of, I think it was the illness.
The presenter was ill, yeah.
Yeah.
A so victim to all the stuff that's been going around everybody's had.
That is going around. But it's Threads of History, Elizabeth Monroe's Wedding Dress. And I found out about this last week, and the date fits for talking about the wedding dress perfectly.
It does, and it's the law of unintended consequences. This was supposed to be a first Friday program. We've tried to fill out the whole year schedule with activities on the first Fridays, and because of the illness of the presenter, we weren't able to do that. So we postponed it to this Friday, which happens to be the 16th, which is in fact the wedding anniversary date for James and Elizabeth Monroe. So everybody out there go,
isn't that something?
Yeah, we had actually thought about doing it on this date originally and said, no, well, we want to keep to the First Friday thing. And so fate stepped in and put it on there anyway. So we think it's great.
So and you have the dress.
We have the dress, and I should say there's been a little speculation over the years. There's no documentation of exactly what dress Elizabeth wore. We're relying largely on family tradition. And there are several dresses in our collection that in many cases you will see evidence that the fabric in one dress particularly is much older than even Elizabeth Monroe's era. And it was fabric probably purchased by her mother in the 1750s or so, and then handed down, made into a dress, very possibly worn as her wedding dress. And then her daughters, Eliza and Mariah, one or the other or both used it, and later generations of the family, and it would be altered to some degree or another to fit later fashion. So it's a real cross-generational artifact of the family, and shows how practical they were. They kept recycling that dress. There's at least one other that there's been some thought maybe could have been. They're not wedding dresses in the sense that we think of today. They're not long trained white gowns. They are highly decorative, rich fabric, nicely embroidered dresses, but we go on the family tradition. And the one in particular that is the leading candidate is very delicate. We don't bring it out very often. And Colleen Callahan, the person who'll be speaking, has been the conservator of that dress for us. So she is well-versed to talk about it.
If only someone had taken a picture and posted it on Facebook of the wedding, we wouldn't have this confusion.
Which literally in those days meant posting it on somebody's face.
Didn't
work.
No.
But, you know, we did discover not long ago, a researcher doing a book on Monroe found the actual newspaper announcement of James and Elizabeth's wedding in New York. Little newspaper blurb we'd never seen before. So stuff pops up.
Isn't that interesting how you do find that kind of thing?
Totally by accident. He saw a reference to a bound set of newspapers from New York that he had not looked at before, and almost on a hunch, he went through and started looking, and there it was, a little announcement that Elizabeth Courtright had married James Monroe of Virginia on February 16th.
Isn't that nice? To have these dresses and to know that they were in the family and that long ago, I just think to be that close to history sometimes is really a cool thing.
It is, and it's been a great benefit to us. There's also the caveat that always comes with that you think about your own family stories and how they can get sort of altered a little bit over time, and maybe the original context is not quite understood. Alex Haley's path through roots and using family stories passed into many generations shows how they can evolve to a great deal.
Yeah.
So the folklore aspect you've always got to be a little careful of, and try to make the evidence, let the artifact tell its story with what it says in its condition and what we can learn about it. And you match that against the family history, and hopefully they align. Sometimes there's a little bit of disagreement or there's gaps. But that's what we call reading the artifact. And I think that for whatever questionable areas or gaps we may have, we benefit enormously from the fact that so much of our collection did pass down directly through the family and has that sort of stamp of authenticity to it in that respect.
No, I just think, and like you say, these dresses aren't something that you're able to show that often. So this Friday, it's a real opportunity. It's from 6 to 8, and it'll be at the museum?
Yes, and we decided to alter the refreshment since it ended up on their wedding date. It will be at the James Monroe Museum, and we're going to have wedding cake cupcakes for the refreshment.
Isn't that nice?
I see your face light up when you saw that.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to remember. A couple of years ago, I know we did a story, and I think it was on a Monroe a painting that you were trying to determine its authenticity. Mm-hmm. But the fact that these things still pop up, and we hear about it all the time around here, just with Civil War things, that someone will walk into to the Park Service and say, you know, this has been in the family. It's just interesting that these kind of things still are out there. And I guess that still makes history alive.
I'll tease for a future show. There's another painting, which we are in the process of acquiring, that has its own very interesting story. And it ranges all the way from New England down to Fredericksburg and back. So how's that for a little teaser for the future?
We'll have to do something. I guess in your time over the years in museums, you've seen some pretty interesting things or had some things just sort of pop up.
Oh my gosh. I can't remember how many times there's been just the stray phone call. At the Manassas Museum, I very early on as curator there, we got a call one day from a gentleman who said he had some things that belonged to his great-grandfather who'd served in the Civil War, and might we be interested? And he mentioned one or two things. So the director, Doug Harvey, and I went out to see him. He was living up near Fairfax. And oh my gosh, his ancestor, a fellow named Daniel Reed, had been in the 5th New Hampshire Infantry. He was a wagon driver. Served throughout the war, all through Virginia and other places with the Army of the Potomac. And because he was a wagon driver, he accumulated stuff. He had pistols. He had a saber. He had all sorts of trinkets that he had collected, including a number of things probably lifted from various Virginia plantations. And there was a story in the family that George Armstrong Custer and his wife Libby had spent a night in his wagon. And he had a cabinet card photo signed by Mrs. Custer. So we're not so sure about that, but he had so many of the everyday life things of a Civil War soldier, plus all these other things that he had, confiscated along the way. It was an amazing collection, largest single Civil War collection that museum ever acquired. And it was just a phone call that said, "Hey, I got some stuff. Want to come take a look?" And there've been other stories like that over the years that just, you never know.
Well, is a little bit of a promo to the James Monroe Museum. I still think one of the greatest artifacts in this area is the desk.
Yes,
that is there. And
the Monroe Doctrine desk. That's right. I mean that has significance to Monroe's early diplomatic career when it was acquired in France, along with other furniture. Stayed with the family throughout their lives. Was used in the White House. During a time when they had no other furniture but their own while they were refurnishing and rebuilding. And by family tradition, by the fact that it's the only large desk he had, it's what the Monroe Doctrine was written on. And so here again, we've got the family's possession of it throughout that time, to the time of the founding of the museum, the family stories, and then the documentary evidence of the artifact's style and construction from France. So it's this premier artifact in the collection.
And it's not quite up there, but it's a close second, I think. Now is I've got it. I haven't even told you this. Another one of my new favorite artifacts in the area is the china that you have, the White House china. And I know you don't know if it was actually used in the White House.
Oh no, we have two sets there. Yeah, we have an exhibit up currently called Dynamic Ceramics, and There's a maroon bordered china that the Monroes ordered. That is specifically documented. That is the first china acquired for use in the White House.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah, that one is known. There is a white set that we have several pieces of with a gold rim and an M design in it, and 20 stars, which we think do correlate to the States. That it's pretty generally thought it was likely the Monroes' formal dinner china. The red bordered is a dessert service when people took dessert a lot more seriously than they do now. But right up to the White House curators over the years, there's been some speculation, but generally thought that white service that we have was their dinner china. So we do have various pieces from throughout the family's life, some of the later family pieces, and different styles of ceramics, earthenware, stoneware, porcelain. And our curator, Jared, has done a great job in not only exhibiting these items, but talking about their production. We even have examples that people can handle and touch, because he's a potter too, you know.
Yeah.
Just really some nice tactile experience to go with it.
So anyway, if you're looking for a museum to go to, there is the James Monroe Museum has a lot of
really... We're blessed with many fine ones,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, it does.
But I'm biased. I'm biased for at least two now.
and the other thing I remember we did it something because you try the it has a name and all I ever refer to it is the plaster thing.
Oh, the bas relief.
Yeah.
Of the signing of the Louisiana Purchase Treaty. Yes.
Yeah.
That big 600-pound.
It's huge.
Gorilla of an artifact. Yeah,
but
it's wonderful.
It's very fascinating.
It documents a significant moment in our nation's history and in Monroe's career of the best land deal we ever made, tripling the size of the country for pennies an acre, and all because Napoleon wanted to finance some more, conquests in Europe. So, and Monroe, like so many times in his career, is there to help close the deal on the Louisiana Purchase.
So at the James Monroe Museum over on Charles Street downtown, and great bookstore, and you can get a magnet too for a James Monroe magnet.
Join the friends of the James Monroe Museum and get yourself a magnet.
Yeah, so it's a good deal. Scott Harris here this morning. We're talking about the James Monroe Museum. We've gotten through Threads of History. It's this Friday night, 6 to 8 at the museum. It's Elizabeth Monroe's wedding dress on her wedding day. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a Monroe-Madison press conference and other events coming up related to James Monroe and the James Monroe Museum. More coming up on News Talk 1230 WFVA. It's 8:29.
I had the radio on. I'm listening to
Talk Done Right. News Talk 1230 WFVA Fredericksburg, a Centennial Broadcasting Station. Welcome back to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. You can weigh in on today's Town Talk topic on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, your host, Ted Schubel.
Scott Harris here this morning. We're talking about the James Monroe Museum, and we're going to get into some events coming up, too, at Belmont this morning. Again, it is Threads of History, Elizabeth Monroe's wedding dress, this Friday night from 6 to 8 at the museum. And next up will be, I guess this is this the second year that you've done? Is this the second annual sort of a presidential conversation with President Monroe, and this time it'll be James Monroe and James Madison.
That's right. excuse me. Last year, several things aligned. We were starting the Monroe Presidential Bicentennial, which will be with us for the next now 7 years or so. We had President Pano, very new at Mary Washington, and so we were able to sort of bring them into a conversation about their views on education, their views on civic responsibility. Worked very well. We were very pleased with it. It really isn't a press conference. Here's a scoop for you. It's not really a press conference. we didn't quite get it to that point. We do have audience questions, though, that will be asked. But it is more of a conversation. In fact, we're evolving the Monroe Conversations as sort of a branding thing. We have a program later in the year with Dolly Madison and Elizabeth Monroe. Billed as Monroe Conversation.
Yeah.
That's in March. Anyway, yes, President James Monroe will be welcoming his longtime friend, colleague, political ally, and former boss, former President James Madison, to Monroe Hall. Now, we will be in Monroe Hall. It'll be the 21st century, but as far as the presidents are concerned, it will be February 19th, 1818. It will be exactly 200 years before.
Okay.
And they will be in character for the entire conversation. They will interact with the audience, but they will do so from a standpoint of the early 19th century. So we'll see how well people can go along with that. We're basically going to let them go. I'm going to do an introduction, and then when they come out, it's their show. And they will be talking about topics relevant to their political careers, their experiences in government, and it will be done, and as it happened 200 years before.
When it happened last year, because I remember I kept wondering, how in the world is this going to work? And because President
Pano weren't the only one.
Can be President Pano, but President Monroe, Jay Harrison did just a fantastic job of the amount of information that you have to know to be able to do something like this. So I just think the fact that he'll be James Monroe again, and what is it, John Douglas Hall.
John Douglas Hall has been James Madison for a long time.
Okay.
And he inhabits the role possibly even more than Jay does. John Douglas Hall actually lives in Stafford, but he also gets mail at Montpelier addressed to James Madison. He has two addresses on his website, his Stafford address where John Douglas Hall lives and his Madison mail that he gets at Montpelier.
Yeah.
So that gives you an indication. And he Jay Harrison has evolved very nicely to look like Monroe, even though he refuses to age.
Yeah.
And that's a bit of a problem. But John Douglas Hall is spooky lookalike to James Madison. And I've encountered him in different programs where you really just stop and go, oh my,
yeah.
Here he is. Yeah. So we're very excited that we'll have. In fact, this is our Monroe Madison year. We have both the presidents and the first ladies from those two administrations that will be interacting this year. I'm kind of foreshadowing our March 2nd program,
yeah,
our first Friday with the first ladies. But these programs that we're talking about, all of them are at the James Monroe Museum website, jamesmonroemuseum.org, under calendar of events, so you'll be able to get more details. The President's Day press conference, that's not really a press conference, is Monday the 19th at 6 to 8 p.m. in Monroe Hall, room 116, the big lecture hall, mm-hmm, downstairs, and there will be refreshments after that. So we are looking very much forward to that.
And again, the first Friday event is with the first ladies. Same thing again at Monroe Hall.
Right, that will in March. Yeah, that's right. And then in between those, just rounding out February, and we don't always find the way to align a Black History Month program. I mean, we do African American history in other ways at other times, but we also try to program to Black History Month when we can find something that's relevant to our mission and we think fits. And this year, the theme of UMW's Black History Month programming is about fighting back. It's about fighting racism, injustice. In the case of the Tuskegee Airmen lecture, which is a Great Lives lecture, it's about fighting Germans. So there are a number of different things that fit that theme, and we've got one that falls right in there. It's Gabriel's Rebellion. Actually, Gabriel's Conspiracy is the way it's also referred to. And it is the attempted uprising of enslaved African-Americans, as well as free African-Americans, and even some whites that were peripherally involved in what could have been the largest slave revolt in U.S. history, had it occurred, had it actually come off. And the story of how it was planned, how it went awry, and how James Monroe was involved in the situation, both as it occurred and after, is a fascinating story. And so Dr. Douglas Egerton, who's the author of Gabriel's Rebellion, the Virginia Slave Conspiracies of 1800 and 1802, will be discussing Gabriel's Uprising. It is going to be on the 22nd of February, 7 to 9 p.m. in Monroe Hall, 116. So note, that's a little different timing. Most of our other programs are 6 to 8. This one's a 7 to 9. But it will be in that same location, Monroe Hall.
Boy, you think about how history would have changed if this had gone off.
Well, yes. And it's hard to know, whether it would have been fundamental, but I could just say that Gabriel was a very interesting personality. It's a shame there isn't more that was able to be learned about him. But what was learned and what was evident through the testimony of those involved in their trials and what was gathered, he was looking at this not even so much as a racial struggle alone, but as a class struggle. He was looking for the ability to have a place in society and to have a place in the political structure and the economic structure. It was not realistic given our perspective, but at the time, immediately after the Revolution, when revolutionary rhetoric is really inspiring people of all races, it ran right up against the conflict between what the Revolution had been about and the fact of African American slavery. And so he was trying to exploit the very real divisions about that and about class in this country when things were still very much in ferment in our republic. So it is really fascinating, and it had ripple effects afterwards. Several subsequent planned rebellions were inspired or even directly linked to what Gabriel had tried to do. So and it happens at the time of Monroe's first term as governor of Virginia. And so there's a alignment there between Monroe and what's happening with this conspiracy.
Yeah, it's Gabriel's Rebellion. It's the 22nd from 7 to 9, and that is also at Monroe Hall at UMW. In March, again, we're jumping ahead to March, and you may know a little something about this. On March the 15th, 7 to 9, again, Revolutionary Rift, George Washington and James Monroe. Someone named Scott Harris is going to be looking into that. Do you know anything about him?
He's a hack.
I would
recommend bypassing this one because it's all lies. I have the honor of doing our program in March that will be exploring the really complex and shifting relationship between George Washington and James Monroe, from their Revolutionary War service to Monroe's role in Congress in the Washington administration, and then later as his secretary or his ambassador to France, and the consequences of that posting and the aftermath of it, which led to a real rupture in what had been a close relationship that has some overtones almost of a sort of a father-son type of a thing. You know, Washington, the man who never fathered children himself, and Monroe, the man who lost both his parents at a young age. Mm. And without getting too psychoanalytical about it, there are some things there you can see in Monroe's approach, a real admiration for Washington, and yet at the same time some rebelliousness and resentment. And it formed a really fascinating relationship. And you look at Monroe's presidency and you see some echoes of Washington in there too, conscious or unconscious. So yeah, we're doing that on March 15th, 7 to 9 p.m. Monroe Hall, 116. That's our go-to spot.
I guess so, yes.
On campus. I mean, you can't beat the name. You know.
How much younger was Monroe than George Washington?
Oh gosh, I'd have to do the math. I mean, Washington is born...
But there was a number because Monroe was the youngest, wasn't he, of the
founding
fathers?
Yeah. I mean, he comes along 1758, and Monroe, Washington's in the 1730s, isn't it? I should know this.
Yeah. Okay.
And Darren or Bill Garner, if you're out there, call in with Washington's birth year. But yes, there was enough difference. Even though they grew up, they were born just a few miles apart from each other in Westmoreland County, but there was a generational difference there for sure. He was his first commander. He was a man that at the end of his life, he could recall very vividly Washington with the troops at Valley Forge and the other experiences. But they had a profound political clash that ruined the whatever personal relationship they had till Washington's death. And even Monroe would express some regrets about it later in his life.
So it never got repaired.
They never
fully?
Got a chance to heal the breach. No. And it's not, I mean, don't want to foreshadow too much of the program, but it's not as though there wasn't some interest on both sides to try, but their pride largely got in the way. Pride and circumstance just prevented them ever having a chance to sort of, you know, bury the hatchet, which Monroe was able to do with a number of his political opponents over the years. John Adams being a very good example. He almost fought a duel with John Adams over the same circumstances that caused Washington and him to have a problem. But he had a chance to make it up with Adams. He never did with Washington.
Okay. Interesting. This is that's a whole area. We don't hear a lot about that, but, I mean, people are people.
They are. And we tend to not assign the same sorts of, you know, good and bad traits and prejudices and values and aspirations, everything, to people who lived a long time ago. And often we think they were simpler and somehow not as sophisticated, but that's, you know, foolish, really. I mean, people have been pretty much the same since we started to walk upright, and it's the same certainly 200 years ago.
If only they had reconciled that at a building around here, or better yet, at the James Monroe Museum, and, you know,
we could have had Washington Monroe University.
Right, yeah. You could have had your own.
There's another show topic for you.
Yes, there
want
is.
Want to go back to the past?
Yes, as a possible name. Who knew? So again, that'll be Saturday the 28th, and that's the birthday.
That's March the 15th.
March the 15th.
Right,
is when
we're getting too far. And let's not, you know, again, March 2nd, 6 to 8 p.m., our first Friday Monroe Conversations with Elizabeth Monroe and Dolly Madison. Again, two ladies. Heidi Stello and Catherine Spivey, who do wonderful interpretations of these first ladies. Because Dolly Madison is so well known and so well regarded in history, and Elizabeth Monroe is relatively so unknown because of the loss of most of her correspondence and just a different approach and style, they present real contrasts. And yet there's a reflection in their relationship, to the extent that we really know it, of their husband's closeness over the years, too.
Again, the first Friday Monroe Conversations, First Ladies Elizabeth Monroe and Dolly Madison, that will be on March the 2nd. The Revolutionary Rift program with Scott Harris will be on Thursday, March the 15th.
You like the alliteration there in the title?
It is. Yeah. Yes. Somebody spent some time putting all this together at their desk somewhere. Scott Harris here, the Executive Director of University Museums. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about in a couple of events coming up in April at the James Monroe Museum, and also we'll talk about some upcoming events at Belmont, the Gary Melcher's home and studio in Stafford. We'll do that when we wrap it up on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
You're listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Got an opinion about today's show? Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Now, here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Scott Harris is here, the newly minted executive director of University Museums. The James Monroe Museum and Belmont are our focus this morning. Before we get off of the James Monroe Museum and go across the river to Belmont in Stafford, one of the events that I always like is there's birthday cake involved. Saturday the 28th, you will celebrate James Monroe's 260th birthday.
Yes, and it is the 250th birthday year of Elizabeth Monroe. So later in the year, we'll be making a big deal about that too. But yes, 260th birthday James Monroe. He doesn't look a day over 220. So we're very pleased with that. Two to 5 p.m. Saturday at the museum, and yes, there will be cake. There will be all sorts of photo ops, and there will also be music, and visitors will have a chance to sit for a silhouette portrait. We have a couple of silhouette portrait artists that'll be working there, and people have a chance to get their picture made the old-fashioned way, sideways and in profile and everything. And this is not part of the public activities, but going on at that same weekend, we are doing, about every 10 years, we try to do a Monroe descendants reunion. And so at other points in the day and the night before, there'll be some activities that are specific to that reunion. And it's always very gratifying to see some of the direct and also collateral descendants of President Monroe coming together as a family. And we're happy to help facilitate that.
If you go to the website or if you stop by the James Monroe Museum, there's a flyer that has all kinds of information on some of the things that we've talked about. There's a pots and pallets on April the 6th.
Yeah, that's a participatory program that we've got, pottery painting, playing off the dynamic ceramics that we have going on. Now, most of our programming is free. This one does happen to have a fee because it covers material costs and there's some registration required. $15 a person, $10 a person if you're a friend of the museum. And as you say, at our website, there's more information and you can call and get the details from us.
And whether it's the James Monroe Museum or the or Belmont, you can become friends and you can financially help the whole program, the programs that take place at both museums.
Yeah, we rely heavily at both sites on public support through our friends, through other kinds of donations. And it really is the basis of most of our public programming activity. So it's an investment that goes right back into serving the community, serving the visitors that we see from all over the world. And with Gary Melcher's home and studio, if you go to garymelchers.umw.edu, you will be able to access calendar of events there for a number of things that are ongoing, preschool palette classes. We have a number of free public programs that will be taking place in February and March, particularly February 25th. There'll be a curator's tour. They'll have you give you a chance to go behind the scenes of the museum operation. And Joanna Catron, our assistant director and curator, who is the walking institutional knowledge, the world's foremost authority on Gary Melcher's and his art, will be doing that. That's the 25th. It's free to members. Of Friends of Belmont, $5 for non-members, and it's limited to a small number, only 12. So you need to go ahead and call about that, and you can get the information at the website or call 654-1848. March 8th, there will be a program, Crow's Nest, an ecological gem in Stafford County. It'll be an illustrated presentation by Mike Lott, regional supervisor and northern region steward. And that will also be at the pavilion, at the Gary Melcher's home and studio. And a seventh annual, an event that's in its seventh annual iteration here, the Beeping Egg Hunt. It'll take place on March 25th, 2 to 4 p.m. It's a great family event, opportunity for visually impaired children along with their families to participate in an audible egg hunt. And so these and all the things, garymelchers.umw.edu, you can get the full slate of what's going on.
And a number of those we're going to be doing shows on coming up in the next in the next few weeks. But a lot of good things. And as spring comes and when the gardens start blooming there at Belmont, it is a really terrific place. Again, we talked a little bit when we started the show just about some of the changes going on. These are both museums. As the year goes on, there are events all the time at both museums. And we talk about becoming a friend. If you're in this community, these are both sites that are worth your time and energy and money to support.
They truly are, and I'm happy to say I'm a member of Friends of both groups and have been. And it is, as I said, an investment. It is an opportunity to get some benefit from the membership, and their sliding scale. You know, the higher your donation amount, the more opportunities you have.
Yeah.
Excuse me, but. More to the point, I think, is that it does represent a vote of confidence in what we're doing, the community service it provides, fulfillment of the educational mission that both museums have, which is directly relatable to the university as our parent. And I do want to, again, part of this university museum's organization includes the papers of James Monroe, which does not have the same public dimension that the museums have in their programs, and yet they have been a partner with the James Monroe Museum on a very successful traveling exhibit on Monroe's tour. We're working on another one for 2019.
Is that still going on?
It concluded its main run of the northern sites of Monroe's 1817 tour. We are now evolving a itinerary of Virginia sites for it to go to and working on that. But he did a southern tour in 1819. And so UMW students are working right now with us on a tour that will go to those states next year. So we're very excited by that. But the papers are working on Volume 7 of Monroe's correspondence. They got a National Endowment for the Humanities grant that has helped their operation. So we're very excited to have all these elements together in the university museums.
No, and I'm sure the papers are kind of like what's going on at Ferry Farm, the archaeology. It's in a way, going through those papers is the archaeology of the James Monroe Museum.
It is. It's documentary archaeology in many ways because they are not doing every single scrap of anything that Monroe ever signed or read.
Yeah.
They are being selective, but they are literally going through the, if you will, the layers of the correspondence over his career and looking for the things that are most illustrative and most educational.
Scott Harris, the executive director of a university museum's, congratulations. Look forward to the years ahead of us talking about
Thank
all of this
much.
Stuff. Thanks for coming in. That is it for Town Talk. Check out the James Monroe Museum for more information.
Thanks for listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. The views expressed by the host and guests on this program are their own and not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. The Glenn Beck Program is next on News Talk 1230 WFVA.